Today's facial is on Pace 60 in the Blue Rock Collection. Umon's staff becomes a dragon. Engo's introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not by nature different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well versed in Zen koans? See the following. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse, "The staff has swallowed up the universe." Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree, stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. Let me just say that it's a great, great pleasure to practice with all of you here, that you're all making a wonderful effort, and it's just a pure pleasure to sit with people who are really practicing open-heartedly. That's just wonderful, just wonderful. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for making such a superb effort. It's really it's just a pure pleasure to practice with people who are practicing as you have at this session and as you did this morning. It's perfect, right? I mean, it's like for me, just like an undeservedly wonderful development in my life. So, thank you. And don't, everybody's struggling. The koan here is Umon, Yunmen, Master Cloudgate, has a wonderful koan here. For people who are struggling, and in his commentary, in his verse commentary at the end, Secho also wanted to say hello to you all and tell you not to get discouraged. Secho's verse, "The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart." In other words, you know, if you're feeling like you're a fish lying on the bank and you're trying to gasp your air and you just can't get back into the water, Don't lose heart. You know, don't get discouraged. Only be carefree. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? So don't. He's basically saying, "Hey, you know, I've been there. I felt like a fish floundering in the oxygen by the stream, trying to get into it, and unable to do that." When he says 72 blows are not enough, I want to give you 150, please remember that that's a compliment. He's saying, I really care about you. So, everybody's just doing a wonderful job, and it's just what practice is all about. You know, it's nice that we're able to record Teishos, that's Sheen and at Saturday sits. Because some people are unable to make it, and also some people just don't know what Zen is about. So they can listen to the Teisho and begin to form a concept about what Zen is and is not. But please make no mistake about it. Actually listening to Teishos is no substitute for Sesshin. And if people are not doing Sesshin, they are not on the path of Zen. There's no question about that. It is impossible to practice Zen by listening to Sesshin and sitting a little bit now and then. That's not the way. The way is what we're doing right here, and absolutely indispensable. You know, in Western culture, we have the idea that we can be changed by studying what other people have written and by trying to figure things out with our discriminating intellect. And there's a long tradition of this in the West. It goes back to scripture. It goes back to the Bible. And the idea that the truth is all written down in a book, and if we just study the book, we're getting closer and closer to truth. And this is basic Western attitude. And so, if you read the book and discuss it with other people, tear and compare, and debate, little by little your understanding gets better and you're closing in on the truth. Yeah. But this is quite contrary to the Buddhist way of thinking about things. This is a little bit like people who are debating about a travel book and have never been to the country. So, I mean, we really would think that was absurd, wouldn't we? If we had over at Rutgers, we had a department of let's say, South American studies. And the professors had never been to South America, but they debated using old travel logs and maps. And they had like rooms full of maps, and they pulled up the maps and they said, this traveler is the most reliable. No, this one, you know. And they questioned each other's travel logs. You know, well, I have one from the 1500s. Well, I have a first-hand account from the 1700s. And what do you think? Is Brazil north of Uruguay or south of Uruguay? You know, what do you think? What do you think? You know, and, well, let's reason it out, right? I mean, it's absurd on the face of it, right? And indeed, it's absurd to imagine you could think your way to an understanding of South America. It's absolutely absurd. You would have to go there, right? There's no logical reason why, say, Brazil is north of Argentina. And sitting in your study, you can't reason your way through it. You're not going to improve your understanding by listening to talks about my travels in Argentina by somebody who's been there. And you actually have to get a ticket and go, or you have done nothing. You have done nothing. See, this is quite important. Reading about Mexico is not the same as going to Mexico. Going to Mexico is a face-to-face encounter. The reading isn't a pale imitation. It's not going to Mexico at all. It's just reading. So listening to Teisho also is only helpful in the context of practice. So when I give a Teisho, I'm trying to direct my remarks to everybody in the room. I'm trying to put a little something in here for Jackie, and a little something for John, and a little something for ray, and so on and so on. I'm trying to shoot an arrow in their direction, you know. And basically the koan is like a coach's talk. So the coach comes in and he says, try doing this, it's halftime. I know so many about sports, I can't remember. You're in the locker room and you say, try this, try that. You know, I don't know what a coach says. I've never been in a locker room. But you know the idea. I had a swimming coach. Maybe that's good. Swimming coach, I'd say, coach, I have my muscles hurt. I have a shin splint, is what it's called. Or you get these things, these muscle cramps. You just say, swim it out, boy. So that was the closest thing. But the point is, a coach can give you tips, right, on what to do next. And if you were studying, say, tennis, you want to have a tennis coach who says, lift your elbow more when you serve, right? And you say, I keep hitting the net, with the ball. Well, lift your elbow higher, and what do you know? It works. That's sort of what Dokusan is, and that's what Taisho is all about, if you're just listening to transcripts of coaches talking to students and you think you're going to get closer to tennis, I'm learning, let me learn more about tennis this way. It's absurd as imagining that you could understand South America by reading travel books. You just have to go there. And where we're going is very difficult to get to. Very difficult to get to. And that's what makes Zen so wonderful and so special. In this wonderful koan, Master Uma, Master Cloudgate, comes into the zendo to give Taisho, and he held up his staff and he said to the assembled monks, this staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? See, this is a wonderful koan. A wonderful koan because it invites interpretation, right? It invites interpretation. And indeed, the man who, the best translation, I think, of the koans is by Katsuki Sakida. And this book was recommended to me by Edo Roshi, as a matter of fact. And when I read it, I just thought, these are wonderful translations. And Mr. Sakida is a deeply awakened person himself, and so he really knew what he was talking about. But in this case, his notes are really defective, and they're like 100% wrong, which is quite unusual. Maybe he's creating some dust so people will have to find out for themselves. But in his little commentary, he says, the staff represents Zen mind, the dragon signifies the enlightened man. To speak more plainly, you have swallowed up the universe. You have realized the mountains, rivers, and your own self are just the same thing. See, now, I think that's a poor understanding of this koan because it's allegorical and it's interpretive. And the koan is really asking you to have a certain kind, to discover a certain kind of experience. See, so if you interpret the koan as you would a poem, let's say, or a work of fiction, or a symbolic work like Pilgrim's Progress, or Vice is a Giant, and so on and so on. You really are not using the part of your awareness that koan practice requires. So this is, monk Umong comes into the zendo, he holds up his staff and he says, the staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. When that happens, where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world? So this is asking us to have to proceed in a different way, and not with our discursive mind, and to have a certain kind of awareness of the moment. And so what we have to do is sit on the cushion, straighten our backs, breathe through the dantian, through the hara, enter deep samadhi, deep mushin, and then work with the koan. Staff is a dragon, staff. Or probably, in this case, swallow it up the universe. Swallow it up. So basically, the koan is asking us to enter deep mushin and then to notice something about the universe itself. This is what koans actually do. Another way to put it is like this. There is ordinary understanding of the world, ordinary understanding, which is based upon the discriminating intellect exercised by an ego. So all human knowledge, or most human knowledge, is that kind of thing. So, you know, there's what we call ordinary consciousness is built around a person who sees himself or herself as separate from everybody else and basically tries to negotiate with the universe, the people, in order to get what he or she wants and to avoid pain. Okay? And this is the consciousness of the ordinary person. It's self-centered, and it is basically dedicated to the proposition of gratifying wants and avoiding pain. Basically, all human beings spend most of their time, most human beings spend most of their time living in this perspective, living from this perspective. And even sublime works of the arts are generally created by people who live in this consciousness all the time. You know, it's easy to love somebody who might be a brilliant novelist. When I was in high school, I read The Bear by William Faulkner, and I just thought that was the coolest thing I had ever read. And I really thought Faulkner was deeply in touch with something very special. And as I grew up, I had the chance to read a biography of Faulkner. And I began to see Faulkner as a human being, and it really changed the way I looked at his art. You know, Faulkner was only happy when he was writing. He was very unhappy when he was in what we might say other circumstances. So. He didn't have a very happy relationship with his wife. He was socially isolated. And he would, when he wasn't writing, he liked to drink. And Faulkner would just go on huge benders. In fact, just before he went to Stockholm to receive the Nobel Prize, he locked himself in his study and just went on an enormous bender. And a daughter and his wife were very worried he wouldn't be able to sober up in time for the Nobel Prize. And, you know, if you begin to do research on, great artists and great writers, people I've spent my life working with, you realize how many of them are deeply unhappy in spite of their ability to create sublime works of art. Just before I came here, I had just been given a book by, I'm afraid the author escapes me right now, but it's on the Manhattan Project in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, and it has quite a bit on Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer was the great genius who oversaw the project, the invention of the atomic bomb. And if you read this book, you see somebody who's a great genius of science, and yet really quite torn apart by internal contradictions, by vanity, fear. You know, he's capable of things I could never do, like Faulkner. You know, and I revere those accomplishments. But all the ordinary culture that humans have constructed is constructed from the standpoint of the isolated ego. And all the libraries are full of this stuff. Actually, much of the literature on the sacred practices of Zen and other such practices are also written by such people. I love the work of Alan Watts, for example, but he was also quite an unhappy person. He wrote beautiful books about Zen, but his own life was rather confused. So I'm not trying to put down anyone, but I'm just talking about the human predicament, you know. Ordinarily, knowledge is structured from the standpoint of the little self. Now, you know, when we come to Zen, we have to do something rather difficult. When we come to Sesshin, rather, we have to do something rather difficult. We have to enter a different kind of consciousness. And yesterday I said that when we sit on a cushion and we're in pain, we drop the body and we enter a kind of absolute zero of existence. Now, all body sensation can disappear and we're just a disembodied consciousness. And I said that we really start rebuilding the human being in a new way, starting with this disembodied consciousness and reintegrating all the human functions as we go along in our Zen training. This is 100% true. Another aspect of this is that when you enter a deep mushin, have to stay there for a long time. But eventually you begin to experience what you could call an alternative reality. And it's an alternative reality. And it takes us a long time to experience it because we are so crippled by our fears and our attachments and by our cultural conditioning, see. So, it's the case that we have a hard time for those reasons. And yet, what we're doing is really seeing reality not from the standpoint of the small self who is trying to manipulate the universe, but from this empty self, which is filled with compassion, and which is birthless and deathless. See, this is what Buddhism is all about, experiencing the world from another standpoint. It's the standpoint of the universe itself, you could say, of the fundamental reality itself. When you are in deep mushin, and you work with your koan, 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 eventually there might be a sit where the veil parts, is like a curtain that opens up, and you have a glimpse of reality, of fundamental reality, not reality, not the illusions called reality by the small self, but what we in Buddhism consider to be fundamental reality. You know, this is no longer, our perception is no longer constrained by fear and selfishness, and we can really see what the world is like. And our fears and our attachments go to sleep momentarily, and our prejudices and assumptions are swept aside. And the curtain opens up and suddenly we can see reality. And it might just be the strangest damn thing, right? We might not even have words for it, right? Well, in Buddhism we actually do have a word for this. This is called prajna paramita. In English, it's often translated as transcendental wisdom. But it really, what it means literally is the wisdom or the knowledge of the other shore, from the other shore. This is the insight that comes when you have crossed over from the world of illusion into the world of mushin, into the world of shunyata. When the small self disappears, we can see the world from this other perspective. And this is prajna paramita, transcendental wisdom, other shore wisdom. This is the heart of Buddhism. So when we come to Sashin, we are doing the real work of Zen, the real, what the Buddha taught. Sitting in a room listening to a Taisho is good if it inspires you to go to the cushion, and if it inspires you to, if the recording inspires you to come to Sashin. But make no mistake about it, listening to Sashin is not getting you listening to Taisho is not getting you closer to anything. It's merely giving you ideas. But Zen practice is based upon the experience of prajna paramita, transcendental wisdom. And you can only experience that around day 2 or 3 or 4 and on of a sesshin, when you have entered deep mushin, deep mushin. So you know, all of you are really to be commended for wonderful. You are truly practicing what the Buddha taught. You are truly experiencing the path. You know, and it's wonderful. And there's no substitute. Now, the interesting thing is that when we have these glimpses, it can be very strange. You know, it's hard to put them into words. And that's quite important, I think. See, if we don't reason our way into the experience, We have an experience, and then we try to explain what happens. And it could be just a glimpse of something that lasts 5 minutes, or it could be a sit, or it could be a few seconds. It could be just like, boom, gone. But this is prajna paramita. And it's very much like science. Even though science is ordinarily done by people who are very much trapped in the small self perspective, Zen has many things in common, or Buddhism in general has many things in common with science, because it's experientially based. We don't reason our way into anything. We observe. And you know, if you think about it, science is like a system designed to free people from their prejudices, actually. You know, in the West, for a long time, we believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. And we believed that because it was written down in a book. In fact, in many books. And we inferred from the Bible, as a matter of fact, that the Earth was the center of the universe. From Genesis. And, you know, at some point, it became less and less possible, the more we knew about the world, to accept that view. And basically, at some point, some very courageous people said, why don't we actually trust experience and not ideas and receive wisdom? And science emerged out of that, and really nothing happened in the West until people invented science. It was really the best thing that ever happened to us. But, you know, it's still structured from the standpoint of the small self. Buddhism is like science, but from the standpoint of the empty self, of the empty self. And this is a self that's no longer fearful, no longer attached. And when it sees the world, it sees it without obstruction, or so we think. And it's hard to get there because, you know, all your life, people have told you things which are supposed to be true. And you sit on the cushion, and you see something or you begin to notice something that doesn't fit with what people tell you. You know, when I was doing the breath perception koan, Genki Roshi just said, Genki Roshi used to say, breath with eyes, where do you go? That was one of the ways he would give you the breath koan. He'd say, breath with eyes, where do you go? And, you know, I knew I was supposed to be watching my breath, and I thought he was just speaking metaphorically. So I would watch my breath for a little while, and then I would think, well, this is not getting me nowhere. I need to be with the big boys in Zen practice. I need a real koan. And I would go into Genki Roshi and say, Genki-san, the breath goes in my nose and out my nose, in my nose, out my nose. You know, like case closed, right? And he would just ring the bell, right? I mean, in the classical Zen training, the Roshi rings a bell when the interview is over. And basically, we don't use a bell here because it would be too noisy, but there's a little bell. And I'd go in and see the Roshi and say, you know, I think I've mastered the breath, you know, and he'd bring me out. And then I tried to say something profound, you know, I would come in and say, all is one, you know, everything is one, everything is Buddha. You know? And I tried to be creative, I brought in flowers and things like that. I was a small self. I tried to figure it out. I thought maybe this is a philosophical conundrum, right? And maybe he wants me to be creative. You know, maybe he wants me to surprise him. You know, bringing the sandwich. You know. Basically, all of these were beside the point because I didn't understand that the breath can be experienced in a very different way. And eventually, years later, because I was really a rather poor Zen student, years later, I realized that the breath seemed to be going out my head, you know, and or out my eyes, or I noticed that sometimes my breath just seemed to disappear. And I realized, you know, that these things contradicted what I had been told, but that they were a commonplace experiences if you meditate. And this is because you have a body, a physical body, but you also have what you might call like a psychic body, a Buddha body, which is different from the physical body in many ways. And you experience your existence in a different way when you just pay attention to immediate experience. You perceive reality a different way when you just go with the experience and not what you've been taught or what you infer. You know. So it took me a long time to realize that experientially the breath is quite different from what I thought. And it wasn't just that I was dope. You know, I had all these assumptions that I learned from growing up. That I learned from culture. And as you go along in Zen practice, you keep encountering these, right? You know, reality is supposed to be a certain way. I thought Kensho was going to be like, this sounds ridiculous, but, you know, I thought Kensho was going to be like, angels singing or something like that. You know, I had this idea from my own religious upbringing that, you know, I would have a certain kind of experience, and it wasn't anything like that. You know, anything like what I thought. My culture hadn't really prepared me for what actually happened. And this is true on every level, you know, at every level of Zen practice. So what we're doing here is experiencing the world not in ordinary consciousness, but in the awakened consciousness, in Buddha mind, from the standpoint of Mu Xin, and we're trying to get past our culture, our culture and our prior mistaken assumptions, and see reality just as it is, or we're trying to experience some aspect of reality in a new way. So calling Mu is also a different kind of you're acting from a standpoint which is different from an ordinary self standpoint. You know, so the ordinary person does things to get a benefit or avoid suffering, right? And the whole economy is built on this idea. We call it carrot and stick, right? So you give somebody a bonus, an incentive, and he works harder. And then if the person tries to stop working, you demote him. And then that embarrasses him, so that's the stick. So people can be quite thoroughly manipulated in this way. It's just like two levers, selfishness and fear. You can just pull one or pull the other. Now, you know, mostly when we act, we're acting from one of those two motives in the world of the small self. But, you know, a little cricket in the heart is not trying to maximize his advantage. See, the universe is just chirping through him. He doesn't know why he's doing what he's doing. It's just an expression of the universe. You know, and when the bird is in the tree, this morning we had some last birds of this long summer going away now. You know, they're not trying to do something. You know, ornithologists will say, "Oh, they're trying to attract a mate." You know. Actually, that's not why birds sing. They're not trying to attract a mate. They don't know why they do what they do. It's just the universe expressing itself through their bodies. So, you know, we have a very difficult time, if we're in the small self, imagining what life could be like from this standpoint. And we can go to the Buddhism section of the bookstore, and we can read books, and we can listen to tapes, and so on. But what has to happen is you have to be in deep Mu Xin, and then you have to call Mu. Sooner or later, the Mu that comes will not be your Mu. It will be the voice of the universe. And, you know, there's a part of you which has been gone to school for 16 years and so on, and that part of you doesn't believe it, you know. And there's a part of you that's been educated by Western civilization and doesn't believe it. But I swear to you that if you stay in Mu Xin long enough, you will call Mu, and it won't be your voice, it'll be the voice of the universe. And indeed, that's what I'm listening for in the Dokusama, the voice of the universe. And you might feel like an idiot for a long time, but eventually something just happens. It's like, where did that come from? Where the hell did that come from? See, this is an action from the not from the standpoint of the small self. So Zen and Buddhism in general is all about living from this standpoint, spending more and more time not in the small self, but in the other self, in your true nature, in your Buddha nature. And the more you stay there, the more your views become quite different from ordinary people's views. In the sutra, it says that ordinary people live in an upside-down world. Their perception is like totally upside-down. What is good they call bad, what is bad they call good. They're terrified of openness. They're frightened of freedom. You know, I'm not trying to put people down, but if you think we have a healthy society, then more power to you. But I don't think so. It has many splendid achievements, but I'm not sure it's very healthy. So this is a different way to live. This is a way to live, to experience, to act, to do everything. And what we're doing is little by little experiencing little pieces of reality, little glimpses. It's like these are all the glimpses of the elephant, right? So you sit and you sit and you sit, and one day, boom, and you have a glimpse of a foot. And you sit and you sit and you sit and you say, I don't know what it was. I don't know what. It was long and thin and it had hairs at the end. Could it be a tail? You know. And that's how it goes for a long time. You know, more and more you see the whole, little by little, you know, all the pieces begin to fit together and you see the whole elephant. But it's like unlearning and then seeing with new eyes. That's what Zen practice is all about. And the hardest part is the unlearning. The hard part of unlearning is that we have personal issues that get in the way. You know, lack of self-confidence, self-loathing, we've been educated to, my family was really like totally against my doing Zen. My father, rather, was totally against this. And expressed his disapproval on many occasions. And I just had to decide, and it's, everybody has to make a decision for himself. I just had to decide, I've got to do this or I'm going to just blow up. You know, I'm just going to go crazy. I've got to do this. This is where my heart tells me to go. Not everybody's heart tells them to do this, but this was where my heart told me to go. Yeah. So I had a long struggle with that psychologically. But the other obstacle is just the common sense of what our culture has taught us to believe. And so those two things are the whole reason we don't just sit on the cushion and being, you know, opening up and see the elephant. It's just a little harder. So, Umon comes in, and Cloud Gate enters the Zendo, and he holds up a staff, and he says to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe." What he's saying is, please enter Deep Mushin and tell me how this happens. How is it that you can focus on something, and everything else disappears? See, you know, when you're in deep samadhi, deep mushin, and then all of a sudden you hear a bird or you hear the wind, right? We've had the beautiful wind. This has been the weirdest October, you know, because it's hard to tell. Is it summer? Is it fall? You know, it's amazing. And we've had the beautiful moon at night and the beautiful wind. It's just amazing. And you sit here in deep mushin, your mind is blank, and you hear that wind. There's nothing else in the universe but that wind, right? Nothing else in the universe but that wind. This is what Master Cloud Gate is talking about. See, when you enter deep samadhi and then something arises, everything in the universe is just that thing. That's how it is, isn't it? For a second or two, there's nothing else in the universe. Everything is wind. It's like the whole universe is just wind. The whole universe is just bird. The whole universe is, you come out of the Zendo after sitting, you look up for a minute, the whole universe is just moon. See, and he says, my whole universe is just this staff. How can this be true? See, so please don't interpret. That's not a, we can run back to the travel books and say, what is this? Has anybody said anything about this? Authorities, better ask some Buddhologists what this is all about. And what a shame that would be. Or we can read about it and read it and say, gee, I think I'm getting closer to an understanding of Buddhism. It's like, no, you are definitely not. You are making no progress at all unless you're doing this. And it's just shadows chasing shadows. So you are all doing a wonderful job. You are trying to clear away the shadows and having great success. So, you know, success or failure is not really that important. I think it comes when it comes. It's really important is to listen to your true self. And your true self told you to come here. Whatever reservations you had, you put them aside and you came. And that's a kind of life I think is just wonderful to live. You know, my true self has told me all kinds of crazy things, really crazy. And it's been, you know, difficult at times. But I'm so glad I listened to my true self. Now, when I don't, I get into trouble. I suddenly realize, why am I doing this? This is so dumb. I don't want to do this. And then I my true self was right after all. You know, so here you are, you came. You know, and this is, in one way, we're all trying to wake up, but in another sense, we're just manifesting Buddha nature already. We're just being true to our true nature by coming here and practicing. And that's really enough, right? Struggling is being true to your true nature. So already you're fulfilling your obligation. Yeah? You're already succeeding. Whether you answer your call out or not is just a momentary setback. What really matters is that you're living a true life. You know, we're living a true life. And we're living it together today. It's just a real honor, a real pleasure. So Secho, who's also a very compassionate person, says, don't get down in the dumps if you're not answering your call. You know, you're being true to your true self. We've all been there. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. In other words, don't go to some poem. That's a bunch of BS. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and the clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. You know, don't just because you're floundering doesn't mean you're don't lose heart. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. My verse is done. But do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Only follow your true nature. You're following your true nature. It's just wonderful. Stand unwavering. Why be so bewildered? 72 bloated, you know, it's like you're in the Pacific Ocean, and they're saying, "I need water." Right? It's like that's how we are. We are Buddha. We are Buddha nature, and yet, you know, we feel like, "Oh my God, there's no Buddha nature to be found." You know, it's naturally this is going to be the case for some time, but be assured that every moment of your life is unfolding of Buddha nature, as you will certainly see. 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. That means that's Secho saying, I love you. Hang in there.